the Committee of Responsibility.
Okay.
So, and they had a misperception as to what kind of people they
should treat. Well, my job was to assist volunteer doctors who would come to Vietnam in selecting the children. And the doctors were doing the medical stuff. My job was get the doctors to the hospitals or wherever the kids were to, you know, take care of the housing, all the administrative stuff, be the interpreter where necessary. And then once the kids are selected, then to get them through the process of getting them out of the country and to the United States. And that involved getting them visas and passports, and in case of boys, getting them cleared by the police and by the Ministry of Defense. We were taking kids out who were real close to draft age, and they wanted to make sure we weren't taking draft dodgers. And sometimes they won, and sometimes we won. And so it was largely a bureaucratic job of just going around and dealing with all these governmental agencies. And it certainly taught me new language skills. And it got me all over the country. We got to travel all over the place and pick up these kids.
Who provided your travel?
It was really very interesting. This was an extremely anti-war organization, mm-hmm. but we had very good cooperation from USAID, mm-hmm. and from the military. We got whatever the papers were that was necessary to travel on Air America. Mm-hmm. And basically we would go to USAID headquarters and we could sign up, like IBS people could sign up to get on a flight. It's basically a reservation system. It's just like flying anywhere, except you just didn't have to buy a ticket. Mm-hmm. We could also hitch rides on military planes, which is actually sort of easier if you can get onto a military base. Mm-hmm. Nobody asks whether you should be on the base or not. Mm-hmm. If you can get near the plane and they've got a seat, they'll let you on. Mm-hmm. And the trick was getting the Vietnamese on planes and things. But then, generally speaking, we got very good cooperation there. Most of the kids that we brought out came from Da Nang. And so we'd get them in a couple of different hospitals in the Da Nang area. Then we'd get them to the Da Nang airport, get them on an American military plane there, fly to Saigon, and then house them in hospitals in Saigon until they were ready to leave. And then they would fly out on Air Force medevac flights, mm-hmm. that flights that were taking GIs back to the States. I don't know if they just gave us excess space or if they actually gave us space on an equivalent basis. But we would have a group of four or five kids going at one time, and they would get on this Air Force plane, and they would fly. Once they got to the States, I don't know what happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'd get where they're supposed to go somehow. And we would send a young Vietnamese woman who spoke English with each group. And typically the idea was whatever this group of kids were, they would go to the same town. And so there might be three or four kids who would all go to San Francisco.
Right.
And then this woman would stay with that group and would be sort of their social worker for as long as they were here. It turned out that, I was in COR sort of in the middle of things. It was fairly well established by the time I got into it. It expanded some while I was there, and then it continued for a fair time after I left. One thing that I think was already being learned before I got there, and certainly we knew in spades by the time I was there, is the really nagging injury that we were dealing with time after time was paraplegia. Mm-hmm. Partly because there were real issues of Vietnamese pride here. The criterion for taking kids out was that they could not be treated in Vietnam. And the Ministry of Health would have panels of doctors who would pass on each one of our patients. Mm-hmm. We would literally take them in, say, on stretchers or something, and we'd sit them down on the floor in front of this panel of doctors who would look at them and ask questions, and in a rather cold procedure. They did not want to be told that things could not be done in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So they were difficult to get past. But paraplegia was something where they were real happy to see the kids go, because they knew they couldn't handle them. But
it's mostly from mine injuries or grenade injuries? Or
no, most of those are bullets. Generally, no, it's just a shot in the spine.
Right.
And sometimes they were from shrapnel of some sort. We had a huge variety of things.
Yeah, I take that back. Actually, I think a claymore or any personnel mine would kill a child.
Yeah, I mean, you could be really on the fringe of something and just catch one or two pieces. Mm-hmm. We had one kid I remember who pretty much was shrapnel head to foot, but I think he was far enough away that that nothing penetrated that far. I mean, it had taken one of his eyes, and there were, let's see, there was one kid who I remember quite vividly who had lost both of his arms. That was a wonderful one. That was a kid who, as we went along, we became reasonably well known among the medical community. Mm-hmm. You know, we were a little mysterious what we were doing, but you know, it's an available resource, and this is a place where everybody doing whatever they're doing, although they didn't call it then, was networking like crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, you would find out that somebody could fill a niche that you had, and you'd know about those people, and you'd find things. You know, and the military has always operated that way. You know, if you need a new stove, you take your toilet and you trade around till you have a stove. And this is a whole country full of Americans who think that way, and so. The medical establishment found that we were available, and somehow a Navy hospital ship off Da Nang got in touch with us. I don't remember what happened, a letter or cable or something. And said, we got this kid on this ship who desperately needs to go to the States for treatment. And I don't remember all of what was wrong with him, except he was missing his two arms. And so we went to Da Nang, and went with a doctor. I forget which doctor that was, but they would come over for a couple or 3 weeks at a time on a voluntary basis. And he and I got out to the ship, and I remember we spent a couple of days there because transportation to and from the ship wasn't so easy. And met this kid, and decided that he was suitable, but needed to get permission from his parents to take him. And so he told me where he lived, and where he lived was on an island off Hue. And not very far off Hue, you know, just a few hundred yards, but an island nonetheless, and not a very secure place, a place that, you know, owned by us in the daytime and by them at night. And so I said, okay, I'll go up and get permission from your folks. So, I think I had his picture, and I had his name and, you know, the village that he lived in, and I had that information. And I flew to Hue, and I got a ride with a USAID guy out to this island. And I think we drove out and then took a ferry across, but we got onto the island, and I started asking questions. I said, and Vietnamese don't tend to call children by their names. They mm-hmm. call them brother number one, brother right. number two, or start with number two. So you don't get very far asking names. People just don't know them. And so I would say, do you remember the kid who got blown up and lost his arms? And people say, oh, yeah, yeah. And first person who said, oh, yeah, yeah, took me to the grave. I said, no, must be a different kid. And we went through this, and finally somebody said, I know who you mean. And he said, let me take you to his house. And so we go over to the house, and I talk to a woman, and she says, yeah, that sounds like my son. Was your husband around? No, he's out fishing. This is a fishing village, but he should be in any time. And where will he come in? And over there. So we go down to the beach, and just as we get there, this boat is arriving. Oh, I'm sorry. Just before this, at the house, as I'm talking to Mom, a kid comes walking out, and he's the spitting image of his brother. So I know I've got the right place. We go out and meet the boat coming in, and there's Dad, and he looks a lot like the kid, too. And so I talk to the parents, and they're real relieved to find that he's alive, you know, because they just didn't know. And they did the thing that I saw people do over and over again, the most remarkable thing in the world. They signed papers, say, sure, you can take my kid to the United States. You know, the guy doesn't have any real idea. Then the guy said, but he wanted to see his kid. And I said, okay, fine. Let's go to Da Nang. So the USAID guy, who's just sort of wandering around marveling at all of this, he and I and the old guy get in the car, and we go back into Da Nang, and we catch a plane to go, I'm sorry, back into Wei. We catch a plane to go back to Da Nang. And I remember being in the airplane, we're just taking off from Wei, and I said to the guy, have you ever been to Da Nang before? And he says, I've never been out of my village. And so off we go, and then you can imagine this guy, you know, Vietnamese have no conception of geography. They're really horrible at it, and Saigon, Washington, you know, they're both over there someplace. They're a long way away. I don't know how far they are. So really, in a Wei, sending your kid to the United States is not that remarkable. If you've already sent him to Da Nang, you know, the United States is just down the block. It's not such a big deal. But anyway, this guy is getting a real eyeful. He's looking out the window. We're flying along. And we get to Da Nang. And then somehow we get back out to the ship. I don't remember the details of how that happened. I think we stayed at the IBS house. Oh, yeah, I know we stayed at the IBS house. We stayed with the shoeshine boys in Da Nang, which this guy, he'd never seen a shoeshine boy before, let alone a whole house full of them. And boy, did they have stories for him, and he had stories for them, and his accent was so funny, and you know, it was a great cultural experience. We get him out on the ship, and he has this wonderful reunion with his kid. And then we all came back to Da Nang together, and then put the father on the bus back to Wei, and then the kid and I flew to Saigon, and we went on home. But that, for me, was sort of the high point of the whole thing, of a real adventure involved in it, and all these bizarre cultural experiences. And you get to see people doing mind-boggling things that could only possibly happen in a country that is completely screwed up by something like a war. I mean, you know, I don't think I ever have a parent refuse to send the kids. And it would be easy for me to imagine lots of people under other circumstances say, I don't care how bad his injury is, I'm not going to let him leave the country. You know, you just sort of expect a certain number of people would be too scared of the prospect of leaving the country. And people didn't think in those terms.
But Vietnam also has a culture of war and separation.
Yeah.
And they know it's almost inevitable that separation is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the magnitude of it. Yeah. Just probably is beyond thought, but the quality is still there.
Yeah.
And
one kid was really rather standoffish from all of us, and he was quite memorable because he had been shot through his throat, and he had a fairly substantial hole in his throat. It was covered by a piece of gauze that sort of flapped on there. Mm-hmm. And he was in Children's Hospital in Saigon. We brought him down from Da Nang, and we warehoused him in Children's Hospital. And part of the reason he was there is because of his age, but part of the reason is because Children's Hospital had, on their staff, they had some British nurses who were placed there by the British Embassy, and they were tough. They were really tough, and we figured these people could handle this kid, but they barely could. And we'd go out to visit at the hospital, and half the time we'd find him across the street at a little stand, one of the IBS luminaries, named these stands Ning Nongs. That's just a nonsense word.
Trying to think what that meant in Vietnamese.
No, it's just a Ning Nong. It's just a, you know, it's just a little stand that sells cigarettes by the cigarette, mm-hmm. and they have three bottles of soda to sell, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But this was an urban Ning Nong across the street from Children's Hospital, and we'd ride. You know, I'd come up on my motor scooter. Sometimes I'd be with, I think John Spragans was the other person working for COR at the time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there'd be the two of us, and this kid would be sitting over there drinking Coke, and the Coke spurting out the hole in his neck. And so we'd drag him back in where the nurses would try to clean him up and get him back in the straight and narrow. And he was a real handful. We had a lot of trouble with him. But we finally managed to get him out of the country. And he ended up in the Bay Area. And he now lives someplace down around San Jose where he works for a company making, or last I knew, he was making some sort of artificial hearts or something like that. And then he became the subject of a documentary that was on PBS, where he had an arranged marriage with a woman in Vietnam, and he went back to Vietnam for his wedding, and I don't know if he's still in Vietnam or if he's back here, but it's real crazy. But the first time I met him, after I came back from Vietnam, I went to some sort of a COR thing in a church basement here in San Francisco, and there was this potluck lunch, I remember, and I remember this kid being there and come running over to me and just hanging on me, and it was, you know, I was sort of the link to the old country, and it was sort of nice in a way, but it was sort of pathetic, and it turned out his family was fine, and his family here was fine, he was getting along with them fine, but they weren't Vietnamese, you know, and it was the closest thing he had yes. for a while. Then I met him again a few years later, and was able to really talk to him about his experience, and he was really scared of us. At that time at the hospital, when he was running around with the soda coming out of his throat and all, he was convinced day to day that we were going to kill him any time. He thought when he was taken to Saigon, he didn't have any choice about it, but that he was dead, mm-hmm. and that we really were the enemy, that we really were going to do him in, and it took him a long time to really adjust.
Why did he feel that way?
Well, he lived in a place entirely controlled by the VC. The Americans had killed everybody else in his family. And everything he'd ever heard about us was that we were complete monsters. And it was, you know, the fact that we treated him decently, I guess, began to intrude on all of that. But he didn't have any real good way to process it. And so he was just going along with the program just to survive, but he really thought he was under a death sentence. And it's interesting that he's maintained his political views pretty much intact all the way through. I mean, he's really a fervent Vietnamese nationalist. He managed it going through a university education and working in Silicon Valley, you know, he's still there.
But in what sense? Left or right?
Left.
He's managed to first. Yes, I get that. Well, they say a red diaper baby.
That's right. That's right.
But I was joking. I was raised in such a left-wing home that I almost deliberately are more centrist.
Yeah.
Just because you have to define yourself separate from mm-hmm. who your parents are. You can never be what they are.
True.
So you're not.
Yeah.
But
I think what's remarkable about this kid is, he's a man now, but what's remarkable about him is how fervently he stayed true to the ideal of being Vietnamese, mm-hmm. you know, and to the extent of going back there. And as I say, he may be living there now because that was really part of what he was all about is to be back there. Mm-hmm. But it was, he wasn't going to let anybody rob him of his essential Vietnamese character. Mm-hmm. And when things are so much better for him here, you know, he could be quite well off here.
Well, getting back to IBS.
Yeah.
When you left IBS, you worked for the committee. Did you meet John Balaban, by the way? Wasn't he working for the committee?
John Balaban is the person I replaced at COR.
Ah, great. Okay.
I knew him from before in IBS, and as a matter of fact, I think that's what happened. I remember John came to Kanta at some point, and I believe that John was hired by COR when I did not take the position that was offered, and then John came around on one of his trips, picking up kids, and said that he was quitting, and I said, maybe I'll take your job. I think that's sort of the way it went.
And there we go. You left Vietnam in, was it 69?
69, sometime in the spring of 69.
There she is. Oh, hold on. When we were talking about you leaving in 1969, did you just feel your time in Vietnam was just up?
Yeah. Also, I got into a real dispute with COR. A large part of COR's motivation was propaganda. They wanted to be able to bring kids to the United States to show them flesh and blood victims, show them to the American people, and turn the American people against the war. And I didn't have any problem with that as long as it was done in a way that the kids weren't abused. But I thought that that blinded them to other things that really would be more helpful to the Vietnamese. And COR was the mirror image of the Vietnamese medical establishment. They wanted everything done out of country rather than in country. Mm-hmm. And the longer things went on, the more could be done in Vietnam. There was, for example, an American-financed clinic that could handle paraplegics. Mm-hmm. And why not send kids there? There were a lot of ways that I thought we could be of service to kids, moving them around within the country, a lot of things we could do other than just bringing them out. And I was arguing that that should be done from Saigon, and wasn't going too well. And I decided I was entitled to a vacation. And I said, I want you to fly me back to the States for a vacation, and I want to talk to the board. And ultimately what happened is CRO refused to do it, and I quit. And part of it was that we really were at loggerheads over that issue, and part of it was there was something about me that was saying it was time anyway. And someplace along the line, well, actually, even before I went, I had some ideas of going to law school, and someplace along the line I decided it's really time to do that. And so I applied to law school, and I had been accepted a couple of places and so on.
Where did you end up going to law school?
Harvard.
Harvard.
So I ended up, that's Don Luce is responsible for that. By that time, he and I were living together in the same house in Saigon. This was a famous house that...
Yes. I know all about that house. They should know, too.
Right.
Yes.
this was the Boo house. Mr. Boo, who I've never seen in my life, was the head of the Vietnamese Confederation of Labor, which is the government union, and he was really basically a CIA spy. And the Boos, he was never around, but his wife ran this house, big 3-4-story house, and she had lots of extra rooms that she would rent out to various Americans. And COR, someplace along the line, got in there. I think Dick Berliner was the first person to have a room in there. And then I came along and I took the room, I think I took Balaban's room, and at about the same time, then we rented another room that we used as a COR office. And then John Spragans came along and he took another room. And then there was this room that various people went through at various times, and Don Luce was one of the people who lived there. And when I got accepted both to Bolt and to Harvard, and Don said, you got to go to Harvard. I don't know why I got to go to Harvard, but he said I had to go to Harvard, so I went. I mean, what I finally persuaded myself was I wanted to spend some time on the East Coast, and that was all right with me, and it worked out. And by the way, I went back to Vietnam in 87 and went to the Boo House, which was something I wasn't supposed to do. We weren't supposed to leave the prescribed tour, but my wife and I got into a couple of Seclos, and we took off. There were these Seclo drivers who were standing around, and there were, I don't know, half a dozen, and I walked up to the first one I came to, who was probably born about the time I left Vietnam, not much older than that, and I gave him the old address, which I know is not the current address, because they've changed all the street names, and this is on a little tiny street. It's way across town, and it's like three blocks long. I'd give him the old street address, and he says, fine. And so he lines up another Seclo, and I'm sorry, this trip we had just the one Seclo, and we get in it, and he starts driving out toward the place, and you know, he wants to talk all the way, and my Vietnamese is so horrible that I don't know most of what's going on. But we finally get to the block, and I recognize the block, and then I remember what I knew all the time I lived in Saigon, which is the numbers are not in geographic order, they're in the order that the houses were built or something, you know, they're just sort of random, and the house that I'd lived in had been set back off the street, in what I remembered to be an alley. It turns out it's like these things that you remember from when you're a little kid. And this big alley was this little tiny courtyard, and we finally find the place basically by me going door to door and saying, do you know where such and such a number is, and we zeroed in on it. Finally somebody said it's right down there, and I go back, and sure enough I recognize it's been painted, and it's got some wire mesh on it and all that wasn't there before, but it's recognizable. And I ring the buzzer, and nothing happens. And I'm beginning to get a pretty good sized crowd around me. And after a while, a window way up at the top opens, and a woman leans out, and she says something like, "What do you want?" And some kids yell, "Get down here, you got visitors." And she comes down, and she opens this gate that's covered with a steel plate, and you can't see through it. Mm-hmm. And she opens it and very cautiously peers out. And I said, "How long have you lived here?" And she said, "A long time." And I said, "I used to live in this house." And she said, "Oh, yeah?" And then suddenly something clicked, and I said, "Jacqueline?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Nyuk-Nyuk," which was my nickname. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even remember exactly where she fit in the family. I don't know how I know she was Jacqueline, but that's who it was. And so she went in, she let us in, and then and she showed us around. And what we could see was that there were only a couple of them left. A couple of members of the family left there. They had sold all the furniture just to buy food and so forth. And I couldn't get a whole lot out of the conversation. So when we went back to the hotel that night, one of the people who was on the trip had been a Vietnamese woman who had worked with me in COR. Mm-hmm. And I told her about this, and since she knew these people and she had worked in the office there and all, she went back with us the next day, and of course, and then she could translate for us. And we found out is the family was some in the United States, some in France, and that because of their connections with the former regime, they couldn't get work. They were just selling things off and trying to get out of the country, and you know, things were pretty desperate. It was sort of sad, but it was nice to see that the people had gotten out, and and it was fun to see that I could actually get back to my old neighborhood.
I'd love to spend about an hour talking about that trip, because it really is something. I think it's almost a blessing and it's a curse, but an American going to Vietnam is a completely different experience, and it's not the kind of experience you can get in any other country. It's something very, very special. Mm-hmm. And and or at least for people our age. Anyway.
Yeah.
But how'd you, backtracking a little bit, you were probably, you'd probably finished law school and started practice by the time the war ended. What was your feeling when the war came to an end?
Well, relief, but not exactly satisfaction. It was, you know, it ended on such miserable terms for everybody. It, you know, it really hadn't ended for the Vietnamese, and then they're immediately into a battle with China. I was certainly glad to see the Americans no longer involved in it, but then disappointed pretty much up till today with the way America's not been able to reinvolve itself. It was just, why did it take so damn long?
And when you think back on the IVS part of your experience, mm-hmm. Could you give a general considered judgment of what you felt was worthwhile, what was not worthwhile, what might have been done, what couldn't have been done, any kind of reflection on this
one? Well, I don't think that the work I did was directly beneficial to the Vietnamese in any particular way. I think the fact that I was there probably indirectly helped them to the extent that people having experience like mine converted people here, got them to think about the war. Before I went to Vietnam, I had knockdown drag-out fights with my father over the war. Around and have slideshows with my slides and talk to people about the war. And I think that there were probably other instances of that. And I think there's more subtle change, too, of just having a number of people with some actual experience with the country. Mm-hmm. And the word just gets passed out. While I was in law school, I did a fair amount of speaking at anti-war rallies and things. I was on the American Friends Service Committee, had a speakers bureau, and they would send me out, and I would talk to churches and all sorts of places. And I think that had a small part in making things better. But really, the IVS experience was good for me. You know, you've probably heard this a zillion times. I mean, it for me was probably the most important single experience in my life, and that's, you know, for some people they look back and they say their military experience was that. For some people, college. I think for most people in IBS, IBS is it, and it really formed me and most of us in some major way, and so I think it was very valuable to us for that. I hope it didn't cost the Vietnamese too much to educate us. But I'm not sure I would change very much about it. You know, obviously I would change the war if I could change that, but given what was happening, I'm not sure I would have told IBS to do anything any differently. Mm-hmm.
If you could, you mentioned if you could change the war, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, if I could make so there hadn't been one.
Well, one last thing, really, unless I can think of something else quickly, is the Tet Offensive.
Yes.
There's a reason I'm asking this question, you'll find out. I'm doing a book on the Tet Offensive. Actually, it's out July 12th, and it'll be cheap enough for me to get you a copy.
Well, good.
So
good. Yeah. Well, I have a string of these things. I'm the only person in the Bay Area who missed the Loma Prieta earthquake, I think.
Mm.
I was here,
mm-hmm.
and didn't feel it. I was on BART. I was underground.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know until a long time after that we'd had an earthquake. The Tet Offensive was similar. Cai Bea was a place that was pretty active at night with shelling and things. And I've got, you know, I have my souvenir mortar tail at home, and I had mortars hit my house and all around me, and you know, it was a fairly common thing at night. The mortars would come in. I used to sort of worry about what would happen if they came in, and then I discovered that I could hear the mortar leaving the tube at the other end while still asleep, and I would literally wake up under my bed. I mean, you know, human reflexes are quite spectacular, and so I was fairly well defended there. So this sort of stuff would happen fairly often, and it was kind of routine. The notable thing about the Tet Offensive in Kaibea was nothing happened. And the reason was all our locals had gone to Mitaw. And so all of the troops who were normally harassing the town were all down the road. And I heard the next morning something. I don't know if I heard it on the radio or if I heard it from the MACV guys, but I heard that there had been some sort of a big battle in Mitaw. And then the story started coming in, and we started learning that that things had happened all over the country, and more information came in, and eventually, several weeks later, I got out of Kaibea for some reason, and I was headed to Saigon. And I remember flying into Mitaw and just seeing the area between the airport and the town just devastated and just wiped out. It was, you know, it had burned. It had been largely thatch houses and just completely burned. And I had never seen destruction like that. It was really quite something. And then I made my way to Saigon, and I arrived at the IBS house, and I forget who it was I ran into, and said, "Oh, Dennis." And that's when they realized that they had forgot to check on me. They had no idea if I was okay. They were busy sending cables to people saying, "Your son's fine, your daughter's fine, we're coming home," whatever it is. They had forgot to check on me. That's my Tet experience.
Well, after Tet, there seemed to be some volunteers said that there was a kind of feeling in IVS that maybe it was no longer possible to do this kind of work anymore under the circumstances of the war, and offered people an opportunity to cut short their commitment and go home. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I wasn't really directly involved in it because they had told
it had all been done.
It had all been done before I got to Saigon. So that was the first I heard about it. I didn't know people were already leaving. Maybe they had already left. You know, they were getting ready to go home. A lot of those people were people who had just arrived. Or some of them were, anyway, and people who I never met. And I always kind of wondered, you know, just how scary that was. And for me, life hadn't changed very much. Mm-hmm. You know, I was pretty well acclimated to living in a war. Mm-hmm. And you know, you do get along reasonably well. Mm-hmm. You know where to go and when not to go. You know, back in the refugee camps, people would say, "It's time for you to leave now." Mm-hmm. And I know what they meant. And I would get up and I would leave. And, you know, so you had ways of coping. And so I wasn't troubled by the security. And I think that bothered a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I was telling myself that I wasn't, that I could still do the work. But that was unraveling. And that, you know, ultimately led to me concluding I couldn't do the work and leaving Kaibea. Mm-hmm. But that was that particular work I couldn't do. I felt quite comfortable while I was there with COR, mm-hmm. doing that work. I mean, I felt that was useful and something that I still could do.
You know, a lot written about the Tet Offensive and the impact in the United States and things like that. But did you glean from any Vietnamese whether their attitude about the war changed after the offensive? Get any feeling for that either in Saigon or Kanta?
No, I don't. I can't think of anybody in particular. I think Vietnamese ideas about the war were pretty rigid, by and large. You know, most of the people who I dealt with on a daily basis were pretty much wed to the government. Mm-hmm. They had to be to survive. The people who I knew much more remotely, who were on the other side, weren't about to discuss politics with me, and I wasn't going to discuss it with them, even to the extent that I could, given my language skills. we just knew that you didn't do that. There were people who I knew who were VC cadre by night, and who, you know, that's okay. We just, you know, you do what you do, and I do what I do, and I got along with people like that okay, because, you know, they... People would call me things like the American without a gun, you know, or some sort of designation that allowed me to think that they thought I was enough different that they weren't going to harm me. And, you know, that was a perfectly good modus vivendi, and we were all fine. And but there was no way that I wanted to imperil them by having them tell me anti-government things. And so I just wasn't about to get into it.
You just answered four consecutive questions. Oh. Yeah, I told you, that's why this is going so well. But it's important. I mean, David Gilson was the poor American. You know, people knew somehow and understood that may have been easier in Vietnam than in Laos for a variety of reasons, and this we're going to have to work very hard at. But the IVS was not the U.S. government, and despite its connections with, in your case, literally you're living in a Saigon power center.
Yeah.
And the army's there, our army's there, the district chief is there, the advisors to the district chief is there, you know, there's a whole advisory team in the place. You're living in the police chief's house.
Right.
And, but most of your work is just supplying basic needs to refugees.
But I'm the only person, American or Vietnamese, that the people in the refugee camps ever saw come barefoot on a motor scooter. You know, there was something real peculiar about me. and I went barefoot because it was much more comfortable. I mean, you know, I'm of the age where I was probably making a statement anyway, but, you know, it was stupid to wear boots or something like that, you know, so I was being comfortable. And I loved my motor scooter, and I could go places where nobody else would go. And, you know, the Americans always would go with escorts, and they would carry their guns and so forth. And I would show up on my little blue Vespa, and, you know, I probably looked pretty harmless. And word travels real fast in a small town anywhere. And I was there for a long time for them to really get adjusted to, you know, I've never bothered anybody sort of thing. I did run over one poor little kid on my motor scooter one time, and... you know, he ran out in front of me, and we got all tangled up. And I thought there was going to be a little bit of a crisis there, and I had to pay a pretty substantial gratuity to get out from under that, although I was injured much worse than he was. But apart from that, basically, I was a source of amusement and, you know, break up the daily routine.
Well, one IVS remarked that it was his impression that IVS today, or until recently, or whatever, was professionalized.
Yes, it's a much more serious organization.
Much more serious organization, and yet, when you think about it, if you weren't between the ages of 19 and 25, you couldn't do what you were doing.
No.
You'd either be too old and too cautious, or too young and too brash, and everyone seems to have this kind of golden mean between feeling mortal and also being foolish, you know,
I knew then what I knew now, what I know now about what my mother thought about what I was doing, I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have put her through that, you know, but only a callous young man can really do that. Maybe women can to some extent, but I think it's really characteristic of young men to think they're immortal and not give a damn about other people's concerns about this, and just, you know, go off and have your adventure and take these chances.
True, and we've all done those things, but what's remarkable is that 19-year-old soldiers that we sent to Vietnam very often didn't have that restraint. They didn't have perhaps a context either to become so sensitive to Vietnamese. A lot of soldiers, however, did. A lot of that was an element of education, though.
Very few soldiers really had the opportunity to know Vietnamese other than very strange groups like prostitutes and maids and janitors and people like that. The guys who were in the MACV compound near me probably had a better opportunity than most people did, and they stayed holed up in their place most of the time. They really weren't out very much. The medics who would come through would get out a bit, and they seem to have a little better feel for interaction with people. They seem to get more out of it. But the other people who would go in there, just the regular soldiers, I would never see them extend themselves at all to get to know any Vietnamese.
Well, were the medical people there as part of a courts operation?
No.
Providing, you know,
no, they were the...
Or just for the compound?
They were just for the... What was it? I think there were four guys assigned there at a time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a major, a captain, a sergeant who was, I don't know, did communications or something, I guess was really his responsibility, and then a sergeant who was a medic. And I think the real reason for having that medic there is to serve just those people.
Mm-hmm.
But they would get involved in going out and vaccinating people out in a refugee camp or something like that, you know, holding little clinics. Going to the hospital in town, and which was really just a clinic, and putting in some time there. And I think medics are trained by the military to do that kind of civilian
mm-hmm.
stuff, and so it's maybe it's part of their job assignment, maybe it's just part of the culture, but they do it. And the other guys are busy doing their military stuff and having a good time.
What's your practice now? What is it focused on?
Family law.
Family law.
Mm-hmm. Anti-family law, really. We destroy families.
let's be
clear
let's
about
be
what
clear.
We're doing.
No, you preside over the dissolution.
That's right.
Yes,
that's
what
right.
Yeah. Hence your comment to me on the phone, which now I appreciate
yeah.
much greater. Okay, great. I do want to...